this is supposed to be a session on, it's called the push for equality, I think. Somebody asked me if it was called the push for quality or equality. I haven't noticed any push for quality going around. I want to make some observations about, and then let's talk about, what I take to be a very extensive and intensive push toward equality in the United States. It's going on today. You might say, who's pushing? And that's a question we'll get into. Who is pushing for equality? But there's all sorts of evidence in our national life that we are in the midst of a drive toward equality. You say, equality of what? Well, income, status, the goodies, whatever they are. What I mean by that is inequalities in the things that people value have to be defended. They must bear the burden of proof. Perhaps they always had to, but it's becoming increasingly difficult for them successfully to bear the burden of proof. Now, you may think that's a good thing or a bad thing. Probably most important is why you think it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm sure that in some ways we all think it's good, and if one is reflective about it at all, he recognizes that there's some problems with the drive toward equality. But I want to stress this, I'm talking about only within the United States. When I make statements about the extent of equality, income equality, or anything else, I'm confining myself to the United States. I'm not going to get into the question of U.S. versus India. Let me begin with an observation. If you think that poverty, well, the drive toward equality is related to the problem of poverty, to begin with, and if you think that poverty is something related to mankind's physiological needs, you know, everybody needs food, clothing, shelter, and so on, then by any meaningful standard, we have no poverty to speak of in the United States. Now, I know you can always find somebody who's starving, but those few, very few instances of genuine physiological poverty, absolute poverty, are due to abysmal ignorance of some kind, either woeful ignorance on the part of the person who doesn't realize that aid is available, or people surrounding him are just abysmally ignorant of the resources that are available. By any absolute standard, we have gone a long way just since 1965. And I choose 1965 because that was the beginning of the war on poverty. We have gone a long way toward eliminating poverty, measured in absolute sense. That's interesting. So many people, it's become a kind of a cliche. Well, we had this massive war on poverty, we attacked poverty, and we didn't do a thing. Gee whiz, you know, everybody's discouraged. Well, again, if you use an absolute standard, the number of families below the poverty line in 1976 is about one-third of what it was in 1965. That's success, I think. But, of course, the problem is that poverty is a relative thing. Even you take our poverty line, you know, the official poverty line, which keeps going up with inflation, and that can't be an absolute standard of poverty, but because by that standard, over half the people in the United States were poor in 1929. And the majority of Americans poor in 1929, when our standard of living was the envy of the world, you know, something wrong with that. But as soon as you start saying, well, gee, poverty is a relative matter, then you're into the question of equality, aren't you? Then what you're talking about is not, well, I won't say not poverty, you're beginning to talk about inequality. When you start talking about inequality, you can't use poverty lines anymore. You've got to group everybody, set out a distribution or something like that. So I put up on the board, up there, blackboard, some numbers. Can you see them? She ran up and got her notepad, so she's kind of, I don't know, kind of. There's another cliche, which says that there are amazing thing. You know, one of these amazing cliches. Maybe it isn't a cliche in your circles, but among people who deal with income statistics, it's often pointed out that despite all of the efforts since 1930, the distribution of income remains roughly the same. I've put up here on the board the quintile distribution of income. Now, first of all, a quintile, that's a fifth of the population. If the poorest fifth of the population had a share of income equal to the richest fifth, of course, there'd be no real poorest and richest fifth, the lowest fifth would have 20%, the next fifth 20% of the income, and so on. In fact, in 1952, this is 1972. In 1952, the reason for those years, it had to do with census data, it doesn't make much difference. In 1952, the poorest fifth of the population, of the families, had 4.9% of the total income. The next poorest fifth had 11.2%. And then the middle group had 17.1%. This group had 23.5%. And the richest fifth got 42% of the total income. All right? Now, from 1952 to 1972, we had a big war on poverty, didn't we? And all kinds of other things. Rich were complaining that there were lots of wealth and all that. But now look what happened. These are the figures that are usually cited to show that the distribution of income isn't changing. Here's the distribution in 1972. The bottom fifth is a little better off, but that dirty old top fifth isn't much worse off. And roughly, the thing that really strikes you about that is not much change. Over 20 years, not much change. That bothers a lot of people.
Very few Americans say we've been trying to eliminate inequalities. They say we've been trying to eliminate injustices. Slowly and subtly, though, injustice and inequality are coming to be synonyms, I think. That's part of what I mean by the push for equality. But those are discouraging figures. And, of course, some people might look at them and say, well, that just proves what Vilfredo Pareto long ago observed. There is an iron law of income distribution, which says that if you take it away from the rich and give it to the poor, the rich are shrewd enough to get it right back. By the way, there's something to that. I'm not knocking, saying that the rich are... generally, people are rich because they know how to take advantage of situations. And people tend to be poor because they don't know how to take advantage of situations. That may be their fault, not their fault, I don't know. I mean, if you're black, you don't know how to take advantage of certain situations. I mean, the point is, you can't. But I really think that the most important thing to be noted about those often cited figures is that they're highly misleading. That they do not actually reflect the distribution of income in the United States. The second set of figures are not U.S. Census data, but rather they are the census data adjusted for the following things. Adjusted to take account of differences in family size. Adjusted to take account of income in kind. You see, a lot of income redistribution has been income in kind. To take account of taxes, that first one up there is before tax, the bottom one is after tax, and benefits of public education. Those are the four adjustments. Now, there again, it's 1952 and 1972. But when you make what I think are these perfectly reasonable adjustments, then you find out that from 1952 to 1972, the bottom fifth did substantially improve their position. And the top fifth did go substantially down. So we are, in fact, we have over the last 25 years, let's say, we have moved, we have taken some significant steps in the direction of equalizing the distribution of income. So I think that's important. I don't. Have you encountered that statement that we haven't, that the income distribution hasn't changed? Maybe it's...
Okay. I got a book that suggests that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's based on statistical juggling. I run across the statement all the time. It's a commonplace of the New York Times and generally educated people who are familiar with the top set of numbers but have never looked at them critically. All right. Now, notice that that 1972 distribution is still quite unequal. The bottom fifth is getting about a third as much income per capita as the top fifth. Well, can we improve? We should do more. A lot of people think we should do more. As I said, I think this is true, at least among those people who are pushing toward equality. Any inequality, certainly an inequality of that size, requires justification. But now the problem is that contrary to, again, a frequent assertion that I run into, I don't want to pick on the New York Times. I tend to say New York in the New York Times. By that I mean a certain group of intelligent, generally well-informed, not obviously axe-grinding, I don't want to say Eastern liberals, but that's sort of, I mean, you know, the conventional wisdom among the people who read John Kenneth Galbraith is that we should, indeed, we must do much more toward eliminating inequality, i.e. injustice, and that it would be relatively easy. If we just had the will, there's no problem with the way. Well, I want to suggest that there's a very serious problem with the way. That while it, you might, at first glance, think it would be easy to take some from this group and give it to that group, it ain't so easy for one very simple reason. That is, that the marginal tax rates on this group and this group are both very high. This group is paying extremely high marginal taxes, and so is this group. And that's going to screw up any attempt to redistribute income from this group to this group. A marginal tax rate doesn't mean your average tax rate. The poor pay a low average tax rate. In other words, if you take the income, a total income of a poor family, and then their total taxes, you'll find that they pay a very low percent, not very low, but they pay lower than the next group. But their marginal tax rate is much higher. That means the question is, if they got another $10, how much of it would be taxed away from them? And the answer is, among the poor, it's often $10. That's 100% marginal tax rate. And as the people in the upper income brackets will assure you, high marginal tax rates have disincentive effects on earnings. Example. Suppose that we took a proposal that lots of kind, sweet people are earning. They say, why don't we just end poverty overnight? We'll give $5,000 to every family of four. Just, you get $5,000 regardless, by virtue of the fact that you're an American family. Well, all right, that would eliminate poverty. But what would you now do about the family headed by a man who's earning $2.50 an hour and working full time? $2.50 an hour comes to 40 hours a week, $100 a week, 50 weeks in a year, comes to $5,000. He would be earning $5,000 by working, and his neighbor would be getting $5,000 for doing nothing. Will this man continue to work? I've talked to people who say, oh, you're assuming that people are lazy. People won't like to sit around and twiddle their thumbs. No, but people won't sit around and twiddle their thumbs. What they'll do is they'll learn embroidery and poetry writing. They'll go to work for their brother. They'll do things they enjoy doing. Indeed, they may have a creative, much more creative life. I suspect that a lot of people earning $2.50 an hour would have much more exciting and fulfilled lives if they quit working for income. But my point is they will quit working for income.
Yeah, but most schemes fall. We've got some...
Hold it, Al. Oh, I'm going to get there. That's where the problem's going to come. We cannot simply pay $5,000 to guarantee everybody $5,000 and then quit. We've got to worry about the people who are earning about $5,000 or even $6,000. Because if a guy's earning $6,000, he's paying income taxes, Social Security taxes, he's probably paying something to get to work, he's maybe buying clothes to get, all right, there are costs of working. So we're really going to have to worry about the people who are earning as much as $3 an hour. In other words, we get into what is called the notch effect. That if you're going to get everybody out of poverty, you're also going to have to do something about the people in here and in here. You see, if we were to, what we tend to do right now with our welfare programs is we give people welfare and then we tax any earnings that they get at about 100%. And that is very disastrous, has a disastrous effect on earnings. So the answer to this problem, the problem of the notch, is some kind of negative income tax. In other words, what you do is you give people a certain sum of money and then you say, okay, now if you earn something, you get to keep a portion of your grant. What that means then is that this guy, let's say earning, here's a guy who's earning $4,000. All right, you wouldn't just give him $1,000 to raise him up to $5,000. What you do is you give him his $5,000 first, or hypothetically you give it to him, and then you tax his earnings by taking away a portion of the grant. All right, now you tell me, what do you think would be a tax rate that wouldn't have too damaging an effect on his incentives? Huh? I mean, what would be a, what's too high a tax? What destroys incentive? Come on, all you upper middle class people know what high tax, 50% surely, 30%, okay. All right, 30% would be too high?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, so should we tax away at 25%? Tell what? Well, what I want to do is point out, see, let's try a 25% tax. Suppose we let him keep now. We give him $5,000, and we say, okay, now for every dollar you earn, we're going to take away $25. I mean, 25 cents. How much income would he be getting when he went off welfare? Huh? How much income would he be getting? For the whole $5,000 to be taken away from him, he would have to earn $20,000. So we would be paying welfare to families up to $20,000.
Most schemes have a limit.
I'm not going to like that guy.
I know.
I'm trying to get at these things one by one. That's obviously ridiculous, right? But that is what I meant by the problem of, if you're going to get the poor out of poverty and maintain earnings incentives, you're going to be redistributing income heavily into the middle classes, and that becomes fiscally impossible, because it requires you to levy the taxes heavily up here, where the marginal tax rates are already running between 40% and 50%. And these people are just very hard to get additional tax income out of. There are powerful disincentive effects that are going to go to work. You see, we often suppose that what we can do with the, we've got a distribution something like this, and then we can just tilt it like, more like that. But we can't. Anybody who studies in detail the distribution of income knows that what we're going to have to do to avoid, you know, to reconcile elimination of poverty and the maintenance of earnings incentives is boost these people here. In other words, we're going to have to, if this is our original distribution, we're going to have to accept something like this in order to get these people out of poverty. And that's going to put a terrific tax burden on the top. And I would maintain that there's just no way to do it, that there are simply too many ways for the top people to avoid the taxes, including not earning the income. We're just limited in what we can do. We are very close right now, if we're going to try to do it through the tax system, and that's basically the way we've been trying to tax away from some and give it to others through various forms of entitlements. I mean, where you're in a certain category, you're entitled to something. You know, I'm not thinking now about cases of particularly like a blind person or someone who loses an arm. These cases we deal with on a categorical basis. But if we're trying to establish just we're just going to redistribute income, take away from those who are in high income categories and give to those who are in low income categories, we may be very close to the limits of what we can do right now. Al, okay, that was not.
No, I just think that the schemes I've seen would establish limits at the top so that nobody would get more than about $8,000.
Then you either won't eliminate poverty or you'll be taxing at about 75%. There is no scheme. I mean, I'm working, we're at the arithmetic of it. There's no scheme to, I mean, well, what's your poverty income, of course? But if you say that our official absolute poverty line today is the line below, above which you want to raise everyone, there's no arithmetic combination that will enable you to keep tax rates down below 50%.
What's the figure you use?
About 5,000 for a family of four. It's a simple matter of the arithmetic of it. You're going to be paying, you say, if you tax 25%, you're going to be running up $15,000. Paying welfare yet to people, welfare in quotes, people in the $15,000 bracket. Well, what people don't notice is that these schemes either have extraordinarily high marginal tax rates, or they don't really eliminate poverty.
I would use 50%, so it would help somebody.
That would help a lot. I expected to get 50%.
Yeah,
and my point is, it would just run it up to 7,500. But that's still, there's some more problems I'm going to come to.
Would you elaborate a bit more on this marginal tax?
The marginal tax rate is simply, your marginal tax rate, Dave, would be the amount of tax you would pay on another dollar of income that you earn, whatever your income is now. See, suppose you're now earning $50,000 a year. If, you know, just assume, if you earn $51,000, you know, how much of that would go, would be taxed away in all taxes? When you get up into the 50,000 category, that rate tends to be pretty high.
I don't understand then why you say the marginal tax rate for the lowest 20% is high, like it is in
the... because they receive, because their income, not their earnings, but their total income, is heavily of a kind that they lose as they make earnings. In other words, if you're getting a grant of some kind, and a dollar of that grant is taken away from you for every dollar you earn, you're subject to a 100% marginal tax rate. And it's the marginal tax rate that affects your incentives.
But is that the case? I
mean, yeah, with a lot of programs. There's some estimates I've seen that are going to be that there are a lot of poor people who are paying 110% marginal tax rate. Because of the fact that they make earnings, a whole raft of programs for which they're eligible disappear.
People on Social Security will lose their grant if they earn more than 10.
Yeah, but I wasn't thinking primarily that. I'm thinking people are eligible for food stamps, various forms of medical aid,
That's not a tax.
No.
It's a factor of eligibility.
No, but the point is, it's income to them. It is income. Food stamps are income. I'm including food stamps in income, darling. I'm insisting that be meaningful, you've got to include food stamps in income. Maybe you shouldn't include it. Maybe a dollar of food stamps isn't worth as much as a dollar bill because a person would rather not buy food. But still, you may want to discount food stamps to some extent, but you've got to include it in income. Anything which causes a person to lose a dollar of food stamps causes him, my calculations, to lose a dollar of income. If earning a dollar of income causes him to lose a dollar in food stamps, then in my terminology, he's being taxed at a 100% marginal rate. Okay? That's not arbitrary. I think that's the sensible way to look at it if you want to ask yourself the question, what effect on people's behavior will various patterns of income redistribution have? I think you've got to look at marginal tax rates. Another problem, I want to again call these numbers into question, go back to them. You see, maybe the problem isn't as severe as we think because we always measure these income profiles on an annual basis. But wouldn't it make more sense to measure them over lifetimes? Let me give you some figures. If you, in the present time, the median income of households, of families, headed by persons between the age of 14 and 24 is $7,500. All right, there aren't many 14, but the median income of households headed by family members 65 or more is about $6,000. And the median income of families headed by people 45 to 54 is about $14,000. All right? When you stick people who are 20, people who are 45, and people who are 70, or families headed by individuals of these ages, into a single age single distribution of income profile, you're going to get inequality. But is it real inequality? It isn't. I submit the fact that suppose that every one of us over his lifetime earned the same income, but we started slow, rose to a certain peak, and then declined, and of course after retirement our income went way down. Then if everyone received the same income over his lifetime, you would get an unequal distribution of income if you took a profile the way the Census Bureau does it. So a lot of that inequality that you see up there simply reflects the fact that people earn more between the ages of 40 and 55 than they do after 65 or before 25. Another reason for questioning the significance of that is that it ignores a good deal
of income, let's see, well, how do I put it? Income in kind that is a product of choice. Well, look, what I'm mainly thinking of is leisure. If, or another way of putting it is a lot of compensating differentials. If some, well, I know a young man, 20 years old, hale of body and sound of mind, who chooses to work 20 hours a week because he prefers time to write poetry to the things that income, money income will buy. He is by no stretch of my imagination poor. And yet he would fall down there. He heads a family, or he's actually one of those unrelated individuals. He lives with someone to whom he is not related, and hence he's an unrelated individual. So he's one of those families or unrelated individuals, and he is in the poverty category. And I think that's absurd. He's my son. He's just not poor. People differ enormously in their capacity to derive satisfaction from freebies. I'm not knocking anybody with this. I feel sorry for a person who requires a lot of money income in order to have any kind of good time. I'm not saying all the best things in life are free, but I think a lot of them are. Somebody who can derive more satisfaction out of watching the sunset over Lake Union than somebody else can derive from a $7 rock concert is fortunate. He doesn't have to work as hard. Now, there are those differences among people. Now, so that if we were, I just meant, suppose we completely equalized the distribution of income, that would be grossly unfair, wouldn't it? We wouldn't really be equalizing the distribution of welfare, which I assume is what we're after. It's the distribution of welfare that I think is morally relevant. Well, there are other choices that people make. Families make choices about number of earners. These family income distributions, now I'm going back up to the top one because the bottom one is per capita, but of course per capita is affected by that too. If my wife decides to work, our family and per capita income is going up. And if I say woman's place is in the home and she says right on, our family income is going to go down. And I'm not sure that that choice really is relevant to the problem of inequality and injustice as the data would indicate it is. Now, I'm a little reluctant to say this even because I can imagine somebody saying, by God, that's right. We're going to have the government taxing not monetary income, but satisfaction. That would be right, but I don't know how to do it. I wanted to brush through that quickly. I never brush through anything quickly. I want to just comment on some other things and get Al mad. Al, are you feeling pretty good? Okay. The drive for equality, and I really seem to be changing the subject now, but one of the things that the drive for equality has led toward, to, I think, and you may want to refute me on this, is affirmative action plans. It is, we have the drive for equality, and though I may seem to be criticizing it, and I am criticizing it in some respect, it has produced some good things. We have become properly uncomfortable with discrimination against people on the basis of race, and now with discrimination against people on the basis of sex. And I'm heartened and delighted by the enormous strides that we have made in our values, the way my own consciousness is changing. And I long believed that it was unjust to discriminate against people on the basis of race, but I've just learned in the last couple of years that it's unjust to discriminate on the basis of sex. But we have moved toward affirmative action plans, and that's a different sort of thing. We've gotten very impatient. Now, The institution that I know the most about here is the colleges and universities. And it's interesting that about 1970, there was no evidence that, the data indicated that American colleges and universities were no longer discriminating on the basis of sex or race. Now, they had been discriminating for a long time, no doubt about that. And of course, when a faculty, an English faculty, looks around and says, well, we're looking for a full professor, and there just aren't any eligible women or any competent women. The reason there aren't very many competent women at the full professor rank, you know, come up with all the publications, well, that is because 20 years ago they were discriminating like crazy against women. But do we now compensate for that past discrimination by setting up quotas and saying there are X number of women in the population, therefore you've got to move toward... Well, we're doing that, of course. And there's some ironies about this, that these plans, these affirmative action plans, which require universities, they take one of two forms. Either say, by a certain date, you will agree to have a certain proportion of minorities and women in certain ranks, or they say, you will, for a certain period of time, higher percentage of women and blacks than of males and whites. You set quotas, and the university or college agrees to meet quotas. And of course, these are used in private by non-university employers too. But I'm just want to talk about colleges and universities because I'm more familiar with patterns of discrimination there. I think the thing to be noted is that this is indeed, I mean, the affirmative action plans are indeed discrimination. We may call them reverse discrimination, but they aren't really compensating discrimination, because when a 21-year-old male is denied admission, say white male, is denied admission to law school in favor of a 21-year-old black female, even though his record is better, that's not compensating somebody who's now 45 years old, a black female. That guy is being discriminated against. You know, the De Funis case, is that the way it's pronounced? It's at the University of Washington. Marco De Funis was a male who was denied admission to the University of Washington Law School, and very plain that his record was better than some minority, members of minority races who had gotten in ahead of him. And so he filed suit, grounds that he had been discriminated against on the basis of sex and race. And indeed he had. And the thing went up to the Supreme Court. Well, Justice Douglas issued an order to the University of Washington to admit him until such time as the case could be adjudicated. And by the time it got up to the Supreme Court, he had graduated. And the Supreme Court declared it moot and ducked the issue. So the De Funis case was the one people saying, oh, the Supreme Court's going to have to rule on this touchy, touchy question. But it is, I think it is a very difficult question. One of the things that Thomas Sowell has pointed out is that, with some anger, Sowell is a black, he's a first-rate economist. Any university, I think, would be proud to have him. He has pointed out that just at the now women and blacks who are competent, who are making it, are having to bear the burden of the charge that they only made it because they're black or women. And that's it. He says it ain't so. He finds no evidence that, you know, there's some isolated cases, that the women and the blacks being hired by colleges and universities today are being hired because they're women or blacks. But he says the pressure's being put on to do things like that. And while the colleges and universities are pretty good at sliding around it, nonetheless, all the fat old male professors are insisting that, she ain't really no good. She just got it because she's a woman. So, you know, in a way, they're still being discriminated against. Carol?
How many reverse discrimination cases have come up before any kind of court in one?
Here comes our lawyer.
Yeah.
How many cases, Jerry, has somebody, some say white Anglo-Saxon male, claimed that he was discriminated against for reasons of race and sex and won?
I can't give you a box score, but on the way over this morning, I heard on the radio that the Supreme Court had, I don't know if it was a firm or reverse, but it held that the Civil Rights Act of 64, whatever it is, applied equally to white male, whites as it did to any other party. And they ruled in favor of the white male who felt that he had been discriminated against. So that was apparently a decision the court reached yesterday.
It's interesting, Congress is very clear in the statutes. It has prohibited, I know of no instance where Congress has endorsed quotas. Its language is very specifically prohibited quotas, that we do not want to attain equity by establishing quotas. Interestingly, the federal agencies that administer these equal opportunity laws tend to simply ignore plain congressional language. But it's an interesting pattern. It's something I think we reflect on in this drive toward equality. I think it is growing on the basis of something else, a shift in our thinking from equality of opportunity to equality of results. Let me try to describe that this way. Historically, Americans have believed in equality, but what they meant is equality of opportunity. You know, everybody, in other words, we don't want everybody to have the same income, but we want everybody to have the same chance, right? And so lots of racist, sexist, and otherwise bigoted Americans have insisted for years that, by golly, if any female or black can cut the mustard, they ought to get the job. You know. Now, the practice, I think, is probably a little different. But we have had a pretty, I think, thoroughgoing ideological commitment to equality of opportunity. That's sort of the American way. Everybody gets his opportunity. But what do we mean by equality of opportunity? When you start to think about it, does the guy who doesn't get the job because his parents were black, has he had equal opportunity?
No,
of course not. All right. How about the guy who didn't get the job because his parents had genes that gave him a low IQ? Well, you see, the problem I'm trying to suggest is that while we all agree that to discriminate against, to deny a person something simply because he's black is unjust, why isn't it unjust to deny him something simply because he's dumb or lazy? You know, well, now, see, we've tended to argue that intelligence merits reward. But why? Or effort, at least, merits reward. But why? Is the fact that you are ambitious... Oh, you know, I'm fairly ambitious, but it's because I'm hyperthyroid. Now, I didn't do anything. It is what the moral philosopher would call morally irrelevant. My hyperthyroid condition is not morally relevant. It is no reason for me to deserve something. But now, of course, the thing is, what this has led to, and the guy who has most adequately expressed this, I think he's who's created all the talk, is a philosopher by the name of John Rawls, who in a book called The Theory of Justice, and in articles that he'd been writing for 15 years before The Theory of Justice was published, essentially argued that the only justifiable inequalities are inequalities that benefit everybody, and when in doubt, the least advantaged are the first ones that have to be benefited. Which you can justify, in other words, giving the more intelligent man the job if you can demonstrate that by doing so you will not only make him better off, but you make the poor man better off too. And of course that can often be demonstrated. You know, doctors get high incomes, that's unfair. But if we then allowed everybody, you know, if we started an equal opportunity to be everybody can be a doctor. Anybody can be a doctor. Brains aren't important, hard work isn't important, we'll have a lottery. Well, I think we would all be dissatisfied with the results. Even the poorest of us who wanted an appendectomy would prefer that these rewards be distributed somewhat on the basis of ability. But you see, that's morally irrelevant, it becomes functionally relevant. Because we want certain jobs performed by competent people, we will give them the income and the prestige and status that are necessary to attract them into it. But you see how this represents a drive toward equality. Once again, equality, or inequality, in the thinking of lots of people, no longer has any moral foundation, only a functional foundation. And of course, the functional foundation is very easy to criticize.
What I'm suggesting is that more and more Americans are coming to the conclusion that the rich don't deserve to be rich, and the poor don't deserve to be poor. And I find it very, very difficult to refute that analysis. I mean, I just can't see where, you know, what does any of us have that we were not given? You know, so that philosophically, I find myself driven toward egalitarianism. I've been talking about the push toward equality, but maybe I beg the whole question. Maybe there ain't no push toward equality. Maybe I'm wrong about this.
What about the Scandinavian countries? I've heard that they've come closer to doing this than any other part of the world. Is that true?
I won't repeat. I said at the outset, I'm really going to talk about just within the United States. There are a number of reasons. One is my ignorance.
Do they have a technique, or have they gone about it in such a way that there's something they've done that we could copy?
I really think that we are going to get off the track. I think we're going to get into some very, very, even more unmanageable problems. I may be wrong about this again, but I found that the comparisons between Scandinavian countries and the United States, or inter-country comparisons, are tricky. They're very bad guys.
Taking into another category, is there some way by providing more medical care by the government, or by, I understand in Washington State, for example, medical care is much less expensive than it is, say, where I live in Texas, because the state subsidizes it to a certain extent. That's what someone told me. Is that true? For low-income people, maybe?
Well, they have the same welfare program. I'm sure they
have the taxes. But there's not a limitation on, they can go to a doctor with a lower charge fee or anything of that sort.
It's a fixed fee for the welfare people in the state of Washington.
For a doctor's fee?
Yes, but there are certain government, there are certain controls on that fee.
Can they go to any doctor they wish and then they get pay the same fee? That fee?
Well, who gets paid the same fee?
I mean, for instance, a person on a low income could go to any doctor they chose, and that doctor could charge them only a fixed fee because they were in that low income group.
That's correct, if they go to the doctor that accepts welfare patients.
Okay.
Not all doctors accept welfare patients. But that, I'm sure they do that in Texas too, don't they?
Yeah.
There's
one reason why I've seen data that say that in the Washington, California, medical costs are lower because of the success of prepaid medical care delivery programs, which you know, haven't caught on, or haven't been successful in the rest of the United States, but the Puget Sound Health Co-op and the Kaiser Foundation down in California have, according to the data I've seen, really been successful in lowering costs of medical care delivery through achieving a number of efficiencies, although Jim and I were talking about the points out there. There's some other costs that you bear, but the poor people are more, such as waiting in line.
You were saying that what you have that you haven't earned in agriculture, I think you get rewarded differently, because if you're smart enough to plant your crops right and get the right stuff on, it's only produce you get better crops than the man that's too lazy to plant his crops right and fertilize them right.
That's assuming that the man who is smart and industrious deserves a higher income. But the question is, why?
I'm saying higher income, more crops.
Well, more. Why does he want more crops?
What?
He wants more income from sale of the crops, doesn't he?
Well, he can choose to give
it away. Well, yeah, but my question, I understand your question. You're saying that the farmer.
I'm saying he deserves more crops. I'm not saying he deserves more income. But the natural result is
going to
be more crops.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay, all right. We'll grant that the natural result is going to be more crops. And therefore, it's a good reason to put the agricultural land in the hands of people who are smart and industrious. But after they've grown those bigger crops, let's tax away their extra income and distribute it to the people who weren't smart and industrious.
His beautiful farm to look at, and that's his reward. You know, he's got his beautiful.
Well, Okay. I'm not sure what point you're making. What?
Well, in agriculture, the reward is self-evident.
You think that in agriculture the reward is just, you know, the most farmers, they just love to see the corn come up, and they don't care what the price is.
Not as much as people in the city. I mean, they do it just to watch it.
I know some farmers get fairly angry when prices are low, but they may be. There are lots of farmers who get fairly angry when prices are low, and I suspect that it isn't just the rustling sound of growing corn that titillates them. I think there are farmers, and bless them, who, you know, really derive satisfaction from doing a good job of tilling the soil. But, well, and maybe farmers, for this reason, maybe they're closer to the land and closer to nature and God and all of that, and they aren't as interested in income as the rest of us. It's a distinct possibility. But there are a lot of farmers, too, who think that they deserve higher income because they're smarter and work harder. But my point is that there are lots of people now who just say smarts and industry are something you inherited. I think there are farmers, and bless them, who, you know, really derive satisfaction from doing a good job of tilling the soil. But, well, smarts and industry are something you inherited. Along, by the way, with education, too. The fact you went out and got a lot of education, that's not true. You got a lot of education because you're either smart, or your parents had the sense to socialize you to one education, or your parents were wealthy enough to send you to school even though you were a dummy. You know, so that these differences are simply morally irrelevant. Okay, are we in agreement? Okay, Kara?
I want to know if, is the Office of Civil Rights have the authority to make a particular industry, or in my case, a school system, do what it suggests it should do, considering this current Supreme Court ruling that Jerry was talking about? This affects me personally because we have just been subjected to a lottery system which is almost ludicrous. It's so ludicrous that it sounds like Shirley Jackson's story. What first your birthday came out, and then the last number of your social security number, and whoops, you're going next year, and everybody's going to, you know, just keep rotating every 3 years, and it's destroying, you know, it really is destroying the continuity of any particular school. And we left on that note, and there was all kinds of, you know, I've got to write to my friends.
I want to get
the OCR
clear.
Have a right to say, you must do this or you will not get federal funds.
Wait a minute, I want to get something clear first. What they're doing, the contention presumably is that the school district or the authority assigning teachers is discriminating in some illegal fashion. That's the contention. And in order to, but that's what they contend, right? The Office of Civil Rights
contend that.
And in order to eliminate that, they're now saying, all right, if you're not going to discriminate, in order to eliminate discrimination, we will have assignments on a lottery basis. Is that what I'm trying to get?
It isn't assignments. It has nothing to do with seniority or anything else. They just decided that they put all the other whites, you know, in those, you know, there's the Asian, there are those categories that we've been using in school systems for a long, long time without the public's knowledge. You know, does it have a Spanish surname? Is it an other, is it an Asian? Is it, what is it? Is American Indian, black, or other white? And if you're an other white, then you're thrown into a great big hopper, and first your birthday is pulled out and say, next year it's supposed to be May, June, November, and something else. April's the coolest month. And then after that, and then you're put by computer by the last number, your social security number, who knows why, and then you're put in order, and you're the chosen one.
For what?
To be transferred.
Oh, I see.
You know, black to a,
okay.
You know,
and if you're
white,
if,
teachers, yeah, to
and if you're black
teacher.
Or Hispanic,
yeah.
Or something, you escape that lottery.
Oh yeah, to achieve integration,
okay.
On faculty.
Okay. Well, now, first of all, they not answer your question. Office of Civil Rights can get away with anything that the agency with which it's dealing, whether it's a private employer, a university administration, school district, consents to.
and the Office of Civil Rights has some clout. And something, sometimes the answer is going to be, well, what's in the interest of the relevant authorities? If you have a highly persuasive and intimidating Office of Civil Rights official, a compliance officer, and you've got some people in the administration of this business or university or school district who find it in their interest to comply, and it frequently is in their interest to comply.
Well, is it in their interest because the Office of Civil Rights can, in fact, deny federal funds to the school system?
Can give them various hassles and take up their time.
Or can they just hassle them, and if we finally call their bluff, they say, all right, forget it.
Well, no, they don't always say forget. Then it goes to, then the thing can be adjudicated. But the law, what's going to happen if you adjudicate it hasn't been clear up to this point. And the Office of Civil Rights, of course, I know of no instance where a compliance officer, I know of no single instance where a compliance officer will admit that his affirmative action plan entails reverse discrimination. So that's going to have to be proved.
They were going to start a class action suit. I left 2 days after school was out, but they were going to try a class action suit against this, I don't know whether it was against basically the school board, which does not act in the teacher's interest at all, ever, or the Office of Civil Rights. And I don't know if you talk about law to know what that was one of the planned attacks.
Mm-hmm.
But it interests me that if the push for reverse discrimination is a possibility, I think there'll be many suits against that. And it's very interesting because there have been some talk in my particular school, and this is very personal, I guess, but in my particular school there are a large number of Armenians. And talk about an other white that should be a minority. I mean, they don't even celebrate Easter with us now. Jewish and they're not regular Protestant, And so one of the things that they were hoping to do was to start a class action suit just by Armenians to say, we're minorities, so therefore we should be considered minorities. And the other big question is that many, many people with Spanish surnames are no more Spanish than the man in the moon, but are Spanish surname because they've married. And when I came back from New Guinea and was getting my physical examination in the Valley office, first Mrs. Rodriguez was called for the doctor, and she stood up, and she was Scotch-Irish, just like myself. And then Mrs. Gomez was called, and she was German. It's just amazing. And so that there are all kinds of very interesting exceptions to who is a minority. And so another big thing was this question, who's a minority?
Yeah.
For the OCR. And I mean, that's a very specialized situation, just one part of what you're talking about. But
the basic principle involves discrimination, whether or not in the place of the teachers there's been discrimination. And I don't know how you can establish that, but these things are aberrations or facets of it. And it seems to me that there is a principle established. It's H-E-W money, isn't it? That has jurisdiction over
except that 5 years ago, Al, they were saying, like the Chicano community decided that, for instance, they want Chicano models to teach in their schools rather than have white tell them what to do.
Well, however they define discrimination, it seems to me that's not a clear notion. But they have a principle on the basis of which they can do it.
Within the school system, they've got certainly enough minorities to more than proportionate to the population of minorities in Los Angeles, but they're not all of us. They're not all proportionately in each school. So for instance, there might be a more, obviously there would be more black teachers in a community where there wasn't a fairly good-sized population of black students.
Lots of arguments about integrating schools, and lots of arguments for and against integrating faculty. They think somehow they ought to be integrated.
It isn't
some proportion to the population.
It isn't true, though, where there's an all-black that they want black teachers. Now, I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and in our schools, for the last 5 years, there's a certain ratio of black teachers that have to be in every school and white teachers, whether it's a black community or a white community. And that goes with your
custodial nurses or anything. And unless you do this, you do not receive federal funds.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's, you know, it's very interesting.
And maybe you do not get the qualified teacher for this, like when you were talking, you want the best, but you, that doesn't make any difference. And this is causing a lot of parents are very unhappy.
Well, so your statement, they do not get the federal funds. I want to know if some school system said to the OCR, we're not going to comply, would you in fact still get the federal funds?
No, they have the power to cut off the funds.
They cut off funds.
Do they have the power to cut off the funds?
Yeah.
In Chicago for discrimination in the police force.
Yeah, well, see, they tried that with Los Angeles, and I don't think it's going to work.
Whether or not it works is a very complex thing, depending on a lot of political power and all kinds of
things. I think it'd be well. So did that happen?
I think we want to be careful now. I think you're still talking about it. But, you know, trying to get certain mix of kids in a school, black and white, and mix of teachers, school, black and white, doesn't necessarily entail discrimination against any individuals. However, it's likely to, because you're going to be pushing people around. You're going to be saying to some black teacher who would rather teach down here, I'm sorry, you can't. You could if you were white, but you can't because you're black, you go over there. And, I don't know if one could demonstrate that you're pushing people around on a lottery basis, and you're pushing as many blacks as whites around to achieve this. I suspect that would stand up, given court rulings about the necessity of de facto integration.
There's a difference between hiring in the first place, Paul, and maintaining, within a large system, maintaining that absolute balance all the time, and therefore having to shift existing teachers who, say, have taught for 5-6 years at a particular given situation and say, I'm sorry, your numbers come up and you'll have to travel 2 hours by freeway every morning.
Yeah, right, that's right. I think that's discrimination. Now, whether that would be unconstitutional discrimination, I don't know. You know, clearly, the courts have been willing to allow certain amounts of, discrimination, which seem to be necessary to achieve certain overriding public purposes. Clearly, every time, if a kid has to be bused across town because of the color of his skin, whether he's black or white, that's discrimination.
I'd like to discuss compensatory opportunity in the interest of equality of opportunity. Well, I don't see any easy way to say yes or no to it. And in my experience is in the building trades, in which what I knew the fact was about 71, and I haven't followed since, but I have no reason to believe they're changed. The average black, the number of blacks journeymen in building trades in Chicago was about 3%. And the blacks are at least 30, probably 40% of the city. And the average, the percentage of apprentices was 7%. Well, now, unless there's compensatory opportunity in the enlistment of apprentices, you're never going to overcome, it's going to take years and years. If you put, say, 40% of your apprentices black, it would take about 40 years to get 40% of your journeymen.
Okay, now you're using the criterion, which I think is not defensible, the criterion of the percentage which are black and the percentage which are white, which is a result of history. You're using that to determine a policy with respect to present admission to the unions. But I just want to clarify this. I think that all the government ought to do, and I think all the government may constitutionally do, is require that a union begin admitting people without respect to race. Begin now. I don't think that constitutionally federal government should be able to require unions or employers to begin favoring blacks in order to achieve some ratio of blacks to whites in the unions that is proportionate to the ratio of blacks and whites in the general population.
I'm suggesting there's any way to make up for what's passed, but you have to have considerable compensatory opportunity and push to have a ratio now in the police department, fire department. They have put the pressure on to do this because the ordinary processes do not turn this up. And I don't know whether it's discrimination or what it is. I can only say in my own experience that to try to get graduate students in theological school in black is a very difficult process. We took a student who was in the first percentile of his in the examination when he went into college, first percentile. That's the lowest. And if we hadn't given him a compensatory opportunity and looked him over 10 times, he never would have gotten in. Mm-hmm. Now, if we just said, let's put everybody through a kind of equal process and use the same standards, we had said somehow we're going to try to do things, because the discrimination goes way, way back in the culture and is a very difficult thing to overcome, as you know. And I don't know, I'm trying to say I don't have a principle, but I don't think equality of opportunity and just applying the same standards across the board is the answer either. Yet, maybe it will be in 25 years.
Well, Al, I don't think equality of opportunity is any kind of answer at all. I think I just find when I try to stand on the principle of equality of opportunity, it is so systematically ambiguous that it just doesn't say anything. I think that in other times it may have said something in certain limited contexts. Equality of opportunity represents a respectable, defensible goal. But I just don't know what it means today in our culture.
People who go through the college system and made it are people who knuckle under and do what the professors want. They're the least creative of the people. And the people who are creative have fallen out along the way somehow. And you've got to pick up those creative people if you want creative graduates.
Yeah.
And that means compensatory opportunity, not just applying these. So that when that guy went into law school, he said, well, I'm better than the other. I don't know what that means in terms of objective test.
Right. Yeah, it may indeed be that Marco De Funes was inferior to the people who scored lower than him on the test. But his point was, you're only saying that because of the color of their skin. And in fact, I think he had the University of Washington there. If they had done some additional tests, we have reason to believe that these people. But what they did was just say, these are black, and we'll assume that they would have blossomed had they been white, and that they had equal opportunity. And that, and then. Julie?
Oh, yeah, I want to, this has to do with what Al's talking about. I'm really glad he spoke. But you made a statement, I can't remember exactly what it was, but just a few minutes ago, the idea that reverse discrimination and penalizing a person now for the wrong done, not done by him or her, and you said that's morally indefensible. And I find that, I find that really an attractive belief. I've been brought up for so long to see any kind of discrimination for race, color, creed, and sex as so bad. And yet, in this whole question of compensatory opportunity and reverse discrimination, the thing that troubles me is that when I say, well, it's wrong to discriminate against the present, people in the present for evil done by people in the past, it's saying to me like somehow that we've got to solve the problem of the evils of past discrimination without anybody getting hurt. And I don't see any way to do it. It seems to me I have to say that De Niro, whatever his name is, or me or my kid, maybe has to get hurt because it's been so bad. And I don't know another way to, I haven't heard another way to fix it. The journeyman question. I don't think that whether it's their 40% journeyman in the carpenter building trades union is necessarily important. Why should 40% of the population want to be that? But to correct that, the gross inequality, there's got to be more than just not discriminate anymore, it seems to me, or it's going to take so long. Now, and yet I'm bothered by that, very bothered by it, but it's really, it's really a problem. We're going to get hurt. I think a lot of us are going to get really hurt.
Julie, I agree with that, but I think that there are two ways to go at it. One is to arbitrarily discriminate against Marco De Funes. The other is to distribute the burden of paying for past sins across the population. Let me take the example of integrating the schools. What we are presently doing in the attempt to integrate our schools, I beg the question of what the effects of integration will be, but assuming that it's a good thing, what we're presently doing is picking arbitrarily on certain students, and it is, I find it a highly arbitrary process, and shifting them around, subjecting them to the unpleasantness of busing. I think there's a much better way to go about it. We could achieve the same level of integration, and I think we could achieve it with far less social turmoil, by distributing the burden equally among the whole population, simply by paying bribes. If we want, say, in this black school, we want a certain percentage of whites, all right, then we pay bribes to whites to go there. And we raise the bribe until we get enough whites there. And if we want blacks to come into white schools, we pay bribes to blacks to come. And we set the level of bribe at whatever level we need to set to persuade them to come. And then we all pay higher taxes.
I think that's a neat way to beg the question.
Why does it beg the question?
Well, you're presenting a hypothetical program which I think you yourself foresee a lot of pitfalls that could make it disastrous.
I don't know of any pitfalls that maybe it's been seriously proposed by a number of people.
I see many. I won't say
well, it's been seriously proposed and it's been subjected to opportunity for criticism. I have not seen any criticisms.
What do you mean by bribes?
Well, I mean, you give tuition.
There is a voucher system, tuition system where you can pick your own school.
You give a kid, there are all kinds of bribes.
You're going to call it a scholarship? Or you're
scholarships?
The word bribe.
All right, maybe the word bribe is offensive. Yeah,
I know what you mean.
You compensate, you induce, you attract people instead of forcing them.
Kind of like the school in Dallas attracting a football player from Oklahoma.
Yeah, right. You make the school attractive. And then you say, all right, now come one, come all, you want to get more blacks in there, all right? Now you're going to be discriminating on the basis of.
Has this been tried anywhere?
I think it's the way we generally get people to do things we want them to do.
Yeah. Well, she said make.
Has it been tried with schools? Sure.
Making the school attractive is bringing the school up to the educational level, and wasn't that part of some of the problem? Just some of the schools didn't have the same teaching staff, the same amount of money.
That's what we've been reluctant to do. I think we've just been reluctant. We've been reluctant to. It's basically the same sort of. We take the same sort of approach to schools that we took toward getting people to fight the Vietnam War. I don't want to pay higher taxes. What it would cost to get a volunteer military. So what we'll do is we'll discriminate against people who happen to be males and not capable of getting into college and we'll just dump the heavy burden on them and we'll send them. And it works because it's picking on a minority. The reason we aren't out rioting about school integration is because we don't live in South Boston. I feel sorry for the people of South Boston. I don't know why the people of South Boston have to pay such a heavy percentage of the cost for past discrimination.
Evidently, in some communities, disintegration and busing and so forth work pretty well.
If it works pretty well, but I'm saying when students and their parents are indignant about it, I don't think it's fair for the rest of us to say, because of the past evidence of de jure segregation, you people are going to have to suffer. I decide in my righteousness that you will suffer. Yes. We do an awful lot of that.
Making them suffer, they're making themselves suffer by saying they don't want to be integrated. Is integration itself a punishment?
People don't want it. Who are you to say that they're making themselves suffer?
They set up the school districts years ago that made the other people suffer. They made.
They didn't. Now, wait a minute. They didn't. Their parents did. Their parents did. They may have been. Look, their parents. Here's this kid who has to be bused halfway across town. He is a white kid. His parents may have been card-carrying members of the NAACP. I don't even think that if we just bust the white the children of white racists, it would be fair. I didn't anticipate, by the way, that we were going to get focused on this thing of affirmative action.
They should continue what they were doing and keep the other ones up. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're continuing a system that's pressuring other people because you say you don't want to pressure the new group. Well, somewhere it has to be let up.
What I'm trying to suggest what I think is an equitable principle, which is that if we think that our society has been guilty of injustices and that some people currently are bearing the burden of past injustices, then the society as a whole ought to pick up the burden. And we ought not to pick on certain small minorities and say, you bear the burden for our past sins. That's what I think we do, heavily. And I think that's unjust. Evelyn?
Okay, this is another angle, but maybe you don't want to take it up. But as an economist, how do you see the inequality of access to property? For example, there are certain areas of the country where property, let's say a certain desirable section along the river or something like that, is all sold up. It's been in certain families or something like that. And, here's a new generation of people who are landless who would like some property, but there's simply not available. So that's another whole angle. But I mean, there's large blocks of land, let's say, that are simply held for status. Because they've been in the family or something like that. And there are other people who would love to buy land, maybe for the same reason or maybe to develop it, who very often just can't get their hands on land because it's not available. But that too is an inequality. I just wonder whether you care to comment on that at all. Now, of course, I'm thinking of what's happened in Peru and other places where somebody just let us come, land redistribution.
In the United States, I've never been aware of that as a problem. If people have money, in my experience, they're able to get land.
But you see, the people who have the land very often originally didn't have the money. They started encouraging it. Here comes another generation where you have to have an unreasonable amount of money to get the land, which other people have encouraged.
One of the things I hear you saying is that inheritance is kind of unjust.
It's
the part of what you're saying that intrigues me most. Yeah. I don't have any comment on the question of land specifically, but I would like to just call attention to the fact that there is a widespread and growing dissatisfaction with inheritance. Quite a number of people. The most recent was Lester Thoreau, who did an extensive piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine on redistributing wealth rather than income. And he represents a rather large body of, I think, influential Americans who believe that we should definitely have much higher death taxes. Because inheritance, money inherited, or property inherited, is basically unjust. It's not defensible. There are some problems with that. One way you can tax away a person's, you can prevent a kid from inheriting money from his father, but you can't prevent him from inheriting brains from his father. And also, you can't prevent him very easily from inheriting all kinds of other advantages. I mean, before daddy dies, he makes Sonny president of the company, and that's not taxable. One of the dangers of going at the inheritance tax with a vengeance is that it may actually worsen the distribution of income by preventing a lot of people from passing on their wealth to their children in the simplest way, which is, just leave them money at or estate at death. Wealthy, very wealthy people usually have ways to dodge these things. In fact, there are so many ways to dodge them. There are problems that you can give it away during your lifetime, and if you indeed have a 100% tax at death, and you have an effective tax to prevent gifts,
what you're going to do is encourage old people to fritter away their wealth, and I don't think that's in the social interest. They're going to be, our stock capital stock is going to diminish rapidly. But I'm not really addressing your point, but I think it's an important question. I am concerned how many people, how many of my friends, for example, are quite convinced that there are no arguments really against a heavy 95% tax on inheritances.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of weeks ago, I think I saw some kind of special on TV that concerned itself with the right of, I don't know if it's the federal government or not, to create low-income housing situations in a variety of communities. So do you think that federally funded low-income housing projects in, say, upper-middle-class communities would help distribute wealth, would help integrate, would help in any way? Or would this just, would suddenly that upper middle class community then move out and create a lower middle class community using federal funded projects to create a new salary?
I don't know, Carol. Yeah. You raise an interesting question.
I'd like to return for one moment to your initial talk about equality. I don't have the figures, but I'd like to see the figures on what it would cost to provide an economic base at different levels of support and at different percentages of taxing earned income on low level, before I'd be willing to accept immediately your judgment that this is not feasible.
Oh, we can redistribute through the tax system a little more. I'm suggesting that we're getting close to the limits, that's all.
Well, I'm inclined to think that the whole welfare program might be rethought and approached with that kind of fund or amount given with these upper limits and percentage of taxing of earned income, so the incentive to keep on earning because you get an appreciable increase over what you'd get otherwise just from the grant. But I'd like to see the figures before I can't make any judgment until I see the figures, and I think about the use of our income for the military and some other things without appreciable increase in the taxation from the top. So the redistribution of our budget, those are all pretty important.
I'm not going to officially call this thing to a close because I think you're free to wander off when you want to. That doesn't require an answer. You want to see some figures?
No, I was just a little reluctant.
I think you can. I think you can do your own arithmetic and get good figures. You don't have to know very much about our tax structure and about the ways of tax avoidance and behavior of people at low and very low and very high income levels. I think I'm convinced that we have, we've gone through a kind of revolution. We started off, and most societies, trying to eliminate poverty by taking care of the needy, the real needy, and people who knew that these people had special needs would take care of them. Well, then when that evolved, when the state picked up some of these functions, that evolved into categorical assistance. I mean, if you're blind, or you're mother of six children and your husband has deserted you, you establish categories. But then, because you want to hedge these around with safeguards, you don't want to, for example, you say blind, maybe you give a blind man money, but suppose the blind man suppose he's a disc jockey making a fantastic income. Well, or this mother, you want to be sure that she's actually using the money to rear the kids and not drinking booze. So you start hedging it around with safeguards. And then what we drifted into was all sorts of administrative tyranny, the social workers snooping around late at night to see if there was a man there. Because, of course, if there's a man, we don't want some man
who ought to be supporting his family to be shifting the burden on the state. And then about 10 years ago, I think we went through a very healthy reaction against administrative over-control, and we started thinking a lot. That was the time of the negative income tax. We want to say, look, let's abolish all of these categories. Let's just say, give people income. Don't worry about what they do with it and all that. Don't try to regulate them. For one thing, that perpetuates dependence, and dependence creates poverty. So we kind of moved to the idea that, well, if you're, every American's got a certain rights to income. I remember a guy, Elliot Lebo, who was arguing that he went to a Congress some kind of national welfare Congress. He was speaking, and he was supposed to speak on how to get a welfare revolution going. And it was about 6-7 years ago. It was a time when everybody was making non-negotiable demands. And he was considered kind of a radical, and he was going to explain how they were going to radicalize welfare reform. They're going to really reform the system. And he pointed out, says, we're going through a reform right now. We're radical reform. We're making welfare a matter of right. And I think this was a healthy thing, you know, that you're entitled to this matter of right, and you don't have to, you know, kowtow or kiss the behind of some social worker down at the office. The trouble is that we created enormous opportunities for shrewd and undeserving people to take advantage of the system, and that's, you know, what happens. When I think of welfare chiselers, I don't think of poor blacks. I think of middle-class college graduates. There are just an awful lot of people today who are there in those middle and upper, who are getting advantages, taking advantage of a system that was designed to eliminate poverty. But basically, the problem is that when you say, all right, now look, we're just going to trust everybody, we're going to establish categories, and if you fit the category, you get the income. I mean, very simple categories, simple tests. People find ways to fit the categories and get the income. And so you got to go back now to a more personal approach. But is there some way between, you know, just establishing income grants programs for which a lot of people whom we don't want to give income will qualify, and this paternalism which is so destructive? Is there some middle ground? I just keep searching. And I'm coming to the conclusion that, well, I was struck by something. I was in Luther College this spring, and a guy told me, I never had a chance to investigate it further, but told me that there's a welfare officer in the county in which Decorah was located who gets, it's some modest sum, $10,000 a year, which he can dispense at will. And what he does is, when he finds case of need, people come to him and say, you know, like, the example I was given was a guy, construction, he goes off to Iowa City and works and gets his paycheck, drinks it all up, comes home, and the oil is empty and it's February, and the welfare officer fills the oil tank for the family and tries to get the money back. Well, it's a highly personal system, you know, and it has some advantage. But it's also subject to abuse. Boy, you know, what kind of clout does that welfare officer have, you know? But maybe then you control, maybe if you can get it down to a small enough level, I suggest maybe there's about 4 welfare officers, one for each quadrant of the county. And then the people in that county kind of make sure they watch the welfare officer. And when the community is small enough, that sort of thing can work. But most people don't live in Decorah, Iowa. Most of us, we live in a vast, impersonal society. And we're trying to achieve justice, really not for individuals whom we know by name and by face and by situation, but we're trying to achieve justice for categories of people, mm-hmm. Blacks, women, poor people, you know, people who've never had much education, all kinds of things. It's just terribly difficult.
What advantages would that to that social worker, I'm naive, for him to have this kind of clout over somebody? I mean, is there a payoff there, or is it just a matter of personal power?
Well, personal power is what I was thinking of.
But, I mean, he's not likely to, by withholding funds from somebody who he considers to be unworthy, he isn't liable to pick up those funds himself.
No, I just had my personal power at the Aquarius.
Just personal power.
Yeah.
Some of the...
Also personal attitude.
Good. Well, that's part of the power, you know, people.
Well, I think you put your finger on it right there. It's a very difficult thing that we're talking about here. We're all wrestling with it. And I think it would make us who are sensitive to the difficulties fairly reluctant to want an easy road out of it. And I sympathize with this difficult wrestling thing of quotas, yeah, of assignment of teachers. We have that same thing in Houston. And there ain't no easy way.
Yeah.
And this, we can make fun of or react against this computer system which you worked out so ingeniously, or somebody has, and say, I don't want to have anything to do with it because it ain't perfect. There ain't no perfect way, seems to me. And I sense a little bit, and I'm a majority person who am a privileged class, finding these ways very difficult to work at because they're painful. And I don't see without the pain how we're going to get a more just system of pain for those of us who more have had experience of pain. Weaving the whirlwind partly, and
I'm glad you make that point, because well, we didn't get into some of the questions that I thought we'd get into. One I hoped somebody would get into is, why do I raise this question really the question is the dangers of a pell-mell dash for equality. And maybe one of the reasons is that I'm privileged. I'm white and male and wealthy, and maybe I don't want it taken away from me. And yeah, this is Mr. Leaf.
No, I was just going to say, in this income subsidization, if you want to call it that, it's possible now for someone to, that the income is based on per month or something, so somebody can be a sewer pipe layer in Minnesota and work 9 months out of the year, and the other three he draws unemployment compensation while he's on the beach in Florida. Or, you know, there are other things like that, or people looking for a particular specialty job, they can't find a job, so they
I've been curious for a long time about something you mentioned long ago. You said that you were morally drawn to an egalitarianism, and you would like to see the distribution of wealth morally, although
what I meant was, I can't defend inequalities on moral grounds. That's all I said. That's all I meant. I can defend them on functional grounds, some inequality.
There's no discussion about redistribution of wealth as if it were a desirable thing. Makes me wonder what would happen if that were achieved, and what would be the incentives. And you talked about distributing the children in the schools by offering bribes, and you said at that point, that's how we get people to do things.
Yeah.
And what would be the incentive then for change if you didn't have that?
Well, that's one of the dangers of the dash for equality, that I think we are, many of us are minimizing the importance of the problem of incentives. Partly, see, I think that's a problem. I want to make my position clear. What I meant to say was, I cannot agree with those people who think that the rich deserve morally to be rich. I find I can't make a case for inequality in a moral case for inequality in the distribution of income or prestige. But I can make a functional case for it. The functional case has to do with the problem of incentives. That if we absolutely equalize the distribution of all goodies, I think the level of life would sink disastrously for everybody. And John Rawls admits this, who's sort of become the philosopher of egalitarianism, is that many inequalities in the distribution of goodies are justified by the fact that they promote
more for everybody, including those who are least well off. All right. Now, so I'm saying that problem, it's precisely what's bothering you that's bothering me when I say, look, just because we...
accept that it's desirable to distribute income.
Well, but you're saying, I think that if you're worrying about the problem of incentives, then you're saying it's not desirable on functional grounds.
Right, functional, not moral.
If all the money in the United States was divided up by the number of people in the state, how long would it take before that we'd have the same money?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, people use their money differently, and so somebody gets more, right. Somebody fixes up their house, and they make more when they sell it, and all these things.
And would they be different people, or would they be the same people?
Yeah.
Well, would we be very wealthy if we're all distributed equally? It probably would come out to be very little.
Yeah, and even worse than that, see, it isn't just... I think that the seriousness of the incentives problem has been overlooked by people who think that incentive means incentive just to work. And they say, I've heard this argument. John Kenneth Galbraith has made the argument often that people wouldn't just sit on their duffs because, you know, there's an instinct for workmanship. People want to be doing something. Yeah, but that is really the problem in society. That may be a problem, but beg that question. Suppose that everybody has an instinct of workmanship and wants to be doing something. People don't have to be driven to work or pulled to work. They still have to be assigned to specific tasks. That's the problem of incentives. Capital has to be assigned to particular investments. That's the problem of incentives. You have to worry about what I call compensating differentials. You know, if everybody got the same income, let's say, all right, everybody'd work. I agree. Let's say I don't have that base view of human nature. But everybody would want to work as a water skiing instructor.